Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hartman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Now, the latest developments in the Salisbury and Amesbury attacks are still dominating the headlines, with discussion moving to what the UK can do to respond to this attack, which is now presumed to be by the GRU. James, what are we hearing from the government today?
So there's lots of talk today about more commercial sanctions and maybe some cyber actions to be taken against Russia. Part of the government's problem is that it did the obvious thing, expelling a bunch of Russian diplomats who are believed to be linked to the world of espionage straight after the initial Salisbury attack. So what do you do now? I think the most likely route, because cyber can escalate so quickly, I suspect the most likely route is going to be trying to hit some of those oligarchs with ties to Britain who the government believed to be very friendly with the regime. The aim being to essentially say, to kind of put pressure on Putin via a kind of indirect route. You know, you make life much more difficult for his friends. Does that lead to his friends feeding word back to the Kremlin that these kind of operations really aren't worth a candle? But I think there is a brutal truth here, that there is a limit to how much Britain can do. If you look at the fact that the government are saying, you know, we put out a European arrest warrant, an Interpol red notice, you know, the message being that these guys can't leave Russia. Now, that might be quite an effective threat against an oligarch who, if they had a house in Chelsea and a yacht on the Côte d'Azur. But against two GRU operatives, who one presumes have neither of those things, it's not that effective a threat. They probably are going to revel in their, you know, if their names do, their actual names as opposed to their aliases do come out, they're probably going to revel in their kind of celebrity status in Russia.
Katie, what's the mood in Parliament today about this? Obviously, Labour was a bit more conciliatory yesterday, but are Conservative MPs entirely behind the Prime Minister on this? Is this another opportunity for Theresa May to boost her standing amongst her party?
I think when it comes to issues like this, we've seen it before in previous Russia things. In a way, it does play to Theresa May's strengths because she seems very statesmanlike, she seems authoritative, and most people kind of do get behind that. I still don't think there's a... Perhaps, I don't think everyone's in agreement over what they should do in response. You have some people like Tom Tugendhat who often, you know, go and do media appearances and say they want very drastic actions. I don't think everyone's probably on the same page, but we've also hearing, you know, source quotes in various places saying nothing is off the table that suggests something is coming. And we had the UN Security Council also meeting today to discuss this. And I think Britain will obviously be looking for its allies to join and back them. I think it's notable that I don't think Donald Trump has tweeted yet, though maybe he's a bit distracted by an article in the New York Times.
And moving on to Brexit, which is obviously always distracting people in Westminster. James, we've had an interesting story this afternoon, which is the accidental showing of a document about Brexit resilience.
Yes, this is a kind of classic, put your documents in a folder before you walk up Downing Street. John Glenn, the Treasury Minister, has been snapped with a picture of some of the government's no-deal plans. Now, there is a big push on no-deal. There's going to be a cabinet meeting to discuss no-deal planning next week. Mark said, will the acting cabinet secretary kind of really lit the fire under this issue over the summer and kind of has beefed up quite a lot of the plans. But I do think that no-deal is significantly less likely than it was before. That's not because I come to bring news of a great breakthrough in the negotiations. But I think this, I think on the UK government side, I think it is less likely. I mean, I think before the summer we went away, lots of people in the ERG seemed to think that you know, a world trade Brexit was great, brilliant. I understand the return of Steve Baker, who was in government, who had been involved, very involved in no-deal planning. He doesn't rule out no-deal by any stretch of the imagination. He was pushing Theresa May for more no-deal planning at PMQs yesterday. But he has been quite clear with his colleagues that you shouldn't want no-deal. It's not going to be a walk in the park. I think some of them imagined it was all a scare story. I mean, what he has basically stressed to them is there really would be significant challenges to this and significant political challenges to this, especially because it would be impossible to say that the government had done everything in its power to plan for no deal, because it really hasn't. I mean, it might be stepping things up now, but it really hasn't up to now. Then I think on the EU side, I think they have slightly looked over the precipice a bit too this summer, and they are pulling back. I think that they have seen just the sheer logistical complexity of no deal. I think in the event of a kind of hostile no deal, they, as someone in Whitehall said to me, you know, they've seen the kind of sheer difficulty of keeping Ireland going through that. I mean, if this was a no speakers, no deal, so that, you know, the two sides walked out absolutely hating each other, that would create real, I mean, it would be doable, but it would create really big logistical challenges for them in keeping Ireland going. And then finally, there is the most secret aspect of the Brexit talks, which are these discussions between the European Central Bank and the Bank of England. And they are serving as a regular reminder of just how entwined the Eurozone is with the City of London. And again, the potentially kind of catastrophic financial systemic consequences of a kind of no speakers, no deal.
Yeah, and it's this document that's leaked, I think, it does emphasise that you need to look after financial services, and that would be a thing, maintaining confidence. But I think probably the most amusement is that it's called Operation Yellowhammer.
Which is a type of bird, for those interested.
Yeah, so we don't know exactly the reasoning for this code name, but now it's out, they might have to change it.
Katie, in James's column, he obviously talks about the likelihood of a Canada deal. You've looked at the implications of this for the Irish border and the reaction within Parliament.
So if it is a Canada-style deal, we already hear that the Prime Minister is probably quite reluctant to this, even though lots of people around her are more positive. And actually, it's much closer to what Brexit is, who campaigned for Brexit won. When it comes to the Irish border, the whole reason, well, initially the reason we thought that they were staying away from this was it isn't compatible with what Theresa May has promised on the Irish border. So you have a few options open to you. I think it's hard every time Theresa May talks about it, because one thing we've heard about is, you know, some kind of, not a hard border, but some type of regulatory checks. So you could dress it up in a slightly different way. It would be slightly different, and maybe that would be enough to get to be accepted. You're also hearing that actually, given that Barnier does not like checkers, it would mean that he would be more open to coming up with some kind of fudge on the Irish border, because that would be less of a threat to what the EU holds sacred, you know, dividing up the single market. So it might mean that the Brussels side start to be more lenient on that issue, so you can come up with some kind of compromise. I do think, I mean, obviously Theresa May is backed by the DUP, and we also know people like Kate Hoey, even on this podcast, has said that they won't back anything which they think starts to be a hard border. So I think it's the probably the biggest difficulty with this as a solution. But there are reasons to suggest maybe there might be some way to work around it.
James, on the subject of Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland Secretary Karen Bradley has given a statement today announcing that Northern Ireland Assembly members will have their pay cut while the Stormont Assembly isn't sitting. How significant is this?
I think it is significant because The cutting of pay for the MLAs is an attempt to try and kind of hit people in the wallet and get them back around the table. But also, if you look in the rest of the statement, she's also allowing civil servants to take decisions, which just shows you how determined the government is not to impose direct rule on Northern Ireland from Westminster. You know, if you've got to a situation where you're allowing civil servants to take decisions normally taken by elected politicians, it would seem more logical to bring that back to Westminster, where there are at least Northern Irish MPs. The decision to do this shows that the government is going to basically do everything it can to avoid imposing direct rule. And you know, this also obviously links back to Brexit. You know, if there was actually a Northern Ireland Assembly up and running, the Northern Irish border problem would be much easier to solve, because it'd be very hard for anyone to argue with the idea that all these decisions should be devolved down to Northern Ireland, and Northern Ireland in that consensual form of decision making that is enshrined in the way that the Assembly operates would decide whether it was to align, for example, on agriculture with the EU, but on services with the UK or on manufactured goods, you know, all that stuff would be much easier to fix. And this is one of Theresa May's problems, is not only is she reliant on the DUP in Parliament, but there's no functioning Assembly in Belfast.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie. And you can listen to this podcast on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. We also have a special subscription offer for podcast listeners. 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, plus a free limited edition Spectator-branded thermally insulated water bottle. Just go to spectator.co.uk/water. Thanks for listening.